So, welcome to Lecture 13, February 28th, 2023. Lecture notes is page 116. If you are so inclined, there's always a blood shortage. They're doing a blood drive tomorrow from 12 to 6 p.m. How many people haven't taken the midterm yet? Haven't? Okay, so tomorrow, right around 4:30, 5 o'clock, when the midterm's going to close, I'm donating blood. So don't wait to 4:30 to write me about your problems, which tests have been open for a long time. I'm going to be donating blood, but I prefer you to take the midterm, then donate blood, yeah? All right, so we know that. Midterm one is open. It closes when? Wednesday at? 5 p.m. Webbies, have you taken it yet? No. When's it close? Tomorrow, 5 p.m., thank you. Also, closing tonight on its regular schedule is mini test 6. And if you haven't taken it, I wrote to remind you about that as well. So take that too. Enhanced Learning Extra Credit and Pack Back number 4 is up and running. It'll close Thursday, the one that closed last week. This is not an error. Each week turns out to be earning 0.27 out of 0.3. So far, folks have added 0.81% to their final course grade. Doesn't seem like much until you get up to 2+%, and then it matters. Just a reminder about what's going on. So, closes Wednesday at 5 p.m. The current average, I'm delighted, is 74%. Good job for those who have taken it. Keep up the good work. If you don't have any idea what I'm talking about when I mention midterm one, where you been, and info is out on the out on Canvas in the various modules. I'll post midterm grades after this is all done. So, business in the news. Have you guys heard about this new experiment that's going around about the 4-day work week? People have been trying the idea out and seeing how it works. That's not 4 days of like 10 hours a day. It's like 4 work week days, and you get paid for 5. So, after testing 4-day weeks, companies say they don't want to stop. That's a somewhat overstatement, but there we go. A large majority of companies in the United Kingdom participating in a test of a 4-day work week said they would stick with it after logging sharp drops in worker turnover and absenteeism while largely maintaining productivity during the 6-month study. Is this the future of work? Would we like this or not? How many people think they might like a 4-day work week? 61 British businesses, ranging from banks to fast food restaurants to marketing agencies, gave their 2,900 workers a paid day off a week to see whether they could get just as much done while working less but more effectively. The concept has gained new momentum recently as employers and employees seek new and better ways to work. Some of this I didn't go into at all. It's driven by the pandemic and people being away from the office and enjoying their extra time and wanting to go back to the office, trying to keep hiring, keeping employees since the pandemic. It's all part of this as well. On a scale of 0, very negative, to 10, very positive, employers on average scored their productivity and performance over 6 months at 7.5%. A survey conducted halfway through the trial found that 46% of companies said their business productivity had remained about the same, even though their workers were working 4 days a week, while 34% reported a slight improvement and 15% reported a significant improvement. Because we are talking right now about doing marketing research, let me point out that is a marketing research study that's done on this particular topic. We'll be talking about this sort of research more in a bit. At a small digital marketing agency, they staggered everyone on Monday, Thursday, and Tuesday, Friday schedules. I was trying to figure out how do you do this if you need 5 days a week coverage, you stagger the schedule. Each employee has a partner to cover the day that they're off. They stopped holding marathon daily team meetings that go on forever. And how many of you guys have sat through meetings that go on way too long at work? Yeah, on and on and on. Send me an email, we're good. And in longer meetings that involve clients and multiple presentations, employees would drop in for the portions that they're involved in, leave again, depending on how necessary their attendance was. For this company, productivity was the same or slightly improved, and revenue increased 47% compared with the year earlier period. So this is a bit about how it can be implemented. Widespread adoption faces a number of obstacles. Most companies that have experimented with the 4-day work week are smaller employers. Many larger companies haven't embraced the concept yet, and in some companies, trying four-day weeks. Some workers have reported struggling to get everything done in the 4 days. So could it work for all companies? Who knows? We'll see what the future looks like. What do you think about would this work in your future or not? I guess we'll stick around, have to stick around and see. So how many of you guys either have used Tinder or know somebody who's ever used Tinder? Anybody? Maybe a third of us? So, and what about Tinder or some other dating app? Used it or know somebody who's used it? Any more numbers? A little more numbers? So, Tinder, of course, is one of the originals and has a certain reputation about it, if you know what I mean. They want to change that. Tinder moves beyond hookups in surreal global campaign. Tinder gets wildly colorful, as you might be able to see up there, and inclusive in its first global campaign, breaking today, which repositions the dating app, still primarily known for hookups, as a gateway to all kinds of love and relationships. Well, first of all, we just got done talking about going global. They're going global with this. Second of all, later on we'll be talking about branding and repositioning a brand. That's what they're trying to do. The campaign by the ad agency called Mischief, carries the theme, it starts with a swipe. It includes eye-popping print, digital, and out-of-home ads along with videos. The core message is that endless possibilities await y'all, Gen Z, through the Tinder app. However, they choose to define love, from the heteronormative to the sebiosexual gender fluid to everything in between, says the brand. So there's a campaign message, and obviously they're targeting a particular age cohort, Gen Zs. Many executions spotlight queer and trans love. Others take aim at Tinder's long-standing reputation for facilitating one-night stands, suggesting the app can lead to a long-term relationship. So we're seeing the brand messaging for their target market. Here's an ad that suggests they can do more.
When you got on Tinder, you weren't looking for anything serious. But now you have a toothbrush at his place. It starts with a swipe. Tinder.
So it's not, you know, long-term relationships can come out of Tinder as well. Support for LGBTQ plus daters is front and center too, sometimes in provocative ways, like showing a gender-fluid couple in front of a church with the line, someone to go to heaven with. Up on the upper left you see that. The support for LGBTQ plus community is rooted in Tinder's DNA as well, and so the brand message for that target market. The campaign reflects Gen Z in another way. It acknowledges this generation is making love connections over social, political, and environmental issues. Indeed, one of the ads shows a couple staring up at a giant monster made of plastic bottles with a line that reads, someone to save the planet with. So brand message for that target audience. Tinder's research outside the USA helped inform that part of the campaign. Gen Z in Europe is ahead of where Gen Z is in the U.S. on conversations and engagement on sustainability, which we talk about periodically here, and climate change. And that's hot, says Melissa Hobley, Tinder's chief marketing officer. How awesome that people are connecting over this passion. So again, marketing research for action, based on what their global research, understanding consumer values, global marketing, all at work here. The campaign launches today on social media and streaming, followed by out of home. It will roll out across the USA, UK, Germany, France, Spain, Australia, and Brazil, appearing in major cities such as New York, Los Angeles, Paris, London, Berlin, and Madrid. So there's their global marketing rollout plan. For Hobley, that chief marketing officer, the campaign will be a success if Tinder can get beyond the, quote, hookups label and also make marginalized groups feel seen and supported. So there's their campaign goals, a bit of social responsibility in marketing, and a bit of reflecting changing norms in Gen Z's view of the world. Yeah? So we'll have to see if in a bit Tinder has a more friendly, inclusive, long-term relationship image about it or not. All right, so you pick up with lecture notes, page 116, page 206 in the textbook, continuing chapter 8, marketing research, which we just saw some of being applied. So we were talking last time about the beginnings of marketing research. We talked about some marketing program failures. So while I'm going to talk to you about marketing research, I certainly want to recognize not everything works perfectly every time. I'd still rather have some research done than have none. But you have to take everything with a little grain of salt. So what's the approach that we're going to talk about in doing marketing research? We talk about the five-step approach for better actions. And first of all, you have to know what you're doing. You have to define the problem. What are the specific measurable goals for the research and for the decision maker? Sometimes somebody will rush up to me with a questionnaire in their hand and they'll shove it in my face and they'll say, here, how's this? Is this a good questionnaire or not? And I'll say, I can't tell you that. And they'll say, why not? Don't you teach marketing? Don't you do marketing research? Yeah, I do, but what are you trying to accomplish with this questionnaire? What's your goal? What's your objective? I can't tell you if it's any good to. I know what you're trying to do. Sometimes they don't know what their goal or their objective is. So what are some possible objectives? Well, one is to better understand the issue, okay? To do what's called exploratory research. What is the current market's view of Tinder? Do they have any problems with it? I'm not sure. Well, maybe you should find out, maybe you need to find out what the consumer's view is before you move any further. So here's REI stays competitive with clear customer insights for personalized retail experience. Insights drove new member acquisition, etc. So here is REI, America's largest consumer co-op and specialty outdoor retailer, using research to explore what's going on. To understand the relationship between elements better, here is what is happening in the marketplace as we roll out our ad campaign, as we roll out our new pricing strategy, as we open new retail stores. Here is what is happening. Let's get research to understand that. Or to determine how to affect an element of interest, what we here call causal research. I want to increase sales. What happens if I change my price? I want to get more of a particular brand sold. What happens if I change promotion? So that's the idea of determining how to affect an element of interest through causal research. Second, having decided what it is you want to do, you can now think about developing the research plan itself. Research can be expensive. Research can take a long time to get done. How much time do you have? How much money can you sink into this? So I used to do sales forecasting for a corporate headquarter company. Somebody would walk outside a meeting with the whoever's CEO and say, okay, Marks, what's the sale of left-handed avocado microwave ovens going to be in Atlanta next week? I can't go out and do a major research study, right? They need it for the meeting right now. So I had to jump in, look in my data, come up with the best answer right now. I'm not going to, don't hold me to that answer because it's being done on the fly. But that's instantaneous. A lot of studies can be quite expensive, can take a long time to get done. How much money and time do you have? What's the data that you will need to have in order to make your decisions? Since we're talking about marketing research for action, what data do you need? What do you need to know? Oftentimes I see questionnaires that ask a bunch of questions, and I say, if you knew the answer to that question, how would that influence anything you're going to do? Oh, well, what are you wasting time for? What are you asking these questions for if they don't drive you towards knowing what you need to do, what you need to accomplish? You're wasting the respondents' time, you're wasting analysts' time. What do you need to know? How are you going to collect the data? Sampling is the one thing of interest in statistics. How many of you have had statistics and talk about sampling? Yeah? Okay. Woo. So sampling can be something that is important to you. Very rarely are you going to be able to talk to everyone in the target audience, everyone in the population of interest, all the businesses that are out there, all the retailers, all the consumers that are out there. So you're going to do some sampling. For example, you might do probability sampling or non-probability sampling. So let's say I want you to go out and find out the opinions of KSU students about Tinder. and I want you to do a random sample of students, okay? So you say, I got it. So we got our questionnaire, and you say, what I'm going to do is I'm going to stand out here in Risman Plaza? Out here in the plaza outside the library. I think it's Risman or Risman.
And I've heard both of them just this weekend.
Well, there you go, the Risman-Risman Plaza. And I'm going to stand out there, and I'm going to stop, over when people there, lunchtime. I'll stand there lunchtime, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I'll stop every 10th person that walks through the plaza, and I'll ask them this question. Does that seem reasonable? Reasonable? Does that seem unreasonable? 50-50, one or the other. Seems like a reasonable idea for research. Seems like a really dumb idea for research. Okay? So, whether it's reasonable or dumb, here's the next question. Is that a random sample? Stop every 10th person, walking across the plaza, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, every 10th person. How many folks say, yeah, that's a random sample? How many people say, nah, that's not a random sample? Anybody know why they're saying no, it's not a random sample? Do you know why you're saying no? You don't know? Do you know why you're saying no? That's another hand. Okay, let's see if we can determine whether it is or whether it isn't and defend a position. Let's see what happens. So you're saying, no, that wouldn't be a random sample. Why not?
If honest people, like later and whatnot, if it's every 10th person, it might be earlier people don't, like if you're the first person there.
Okay, so you're sort of on track. I would argue that the whole point of randomization is doing every 10th person should pick up those for, those against, whose nerves didn't see bias in that per se. But we want a random sample of Kent State students. That's the point. And what they feel? How many of you are never in Risman-Risman Plaza between noon and 1, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday? What's the chance of selecting you for this random sample? Zero. Therefore, we don't actually have a random sample, even though in our mind we say, well, it's random. No, it's not random in the sense we mean it here. It's a non-probability sample. And the difference between a probability sample, a random sample, and a non-probability sample is a difference to make statistical inferences. In the case of a random sample, each element of the population has an equal and known probability of being selected. In the case of people wandering through Risman Plaza, we have no idea what the probability of you being there that day is. Now, if you said to me, give me a list of all 23,000 students on campus, and I'll select every 10th one, boom, we now have a random sample. Each individual on the list has a known probability of being selected, whatever 10 and 23,000 are. And then you can begin to make statistical inferences. So when you hear a research report during usually elections, they say, this candidate has a 52% favorability rating, plus or minus 3%. That's the idea of a probability sample. They know what that statistical inference is. Now, many, many, many research projects are going to be done using non-probability sampling. It's too expensive, too costly, not possible to do true random research for the studies you're doing. But you should know, indeed, whether you're doing a probability sample or not. You never plan to do any research. I never plan to do any research. Everyone here plans to do research. Well, good for you. Whether or not you ever plan to do any research, one day you may be in a position to read some research that somebody's purporting to you, tells you how to do stuff, how to manage something, how to make a decision. You might want to know, was this done on a probability sample or a non-probability sample? People wandering across plaza at noon. So there are reasons to want to know this stuff. All right, we're going to collect the relevant information. Data comes in two formats, secondary data or primary data. Secondary data are facts and figures already collected, reported, before your project started on a different sample of people for a different time period, on a different set of questions. What? Why would you ever want to use research that was collected at a different time period on a different set of people for a different purpose. Why would you ever want to use secondary data? Oh. Why would you ever want to use secondary data?
It helps you create guidelines, or it helps you paint a better picture in which you can conduct your
research. Right. It's not quite what you want, but it might set the parameters for what you want. It might show you where things were at one point in time. It might give you enough oomph to begin to make a decision or to guide other research. What would one example of secondary data be? Well, for example, internal data that you've already collected in your firm, financial statements, research reports, files that you have, customer letters, sales call reports, customer lists, all in that big database that you have in your firm. Is it costly and take a long time to get those reports, comparatively speaking? Probably not. Especially if you have a good IT system running. Or you might turn to external data, US Census reports. How many people have a generally good image of the US Census and their data? Yeah, how often do they run that data though?
Every 10 years.
So it may be pretty good data, but, and by the way, they take a year or so to get the data out, so it's always lagging. So it's pretty good data, but it's never going to be current with what you need. But it gives you some guidance, gives you some trend information. Trade association studies. Often what we're hearing in class for Business of the News or Marketing the News is from a trade association. Magazines, business periodicals, internet-based reports. These things can then begin to set the parameters, set the guidelines, let you see trends, and sometimes might be good enough because you've got to get an answer right now. We say you should always begin with secondary data. It's there, it's fast, it's available, it's inexpensive, and it begins to give you guidelines and might be good enough. Primary data are facts and figures now collected newly for the project at hand. We can do things like observe people, watch them to see how they're behaving, see how they're acting in our store, using our product, on the shop floor making stuff. So we have mechanical and electronic approaches to observing people. We use personal approaches where we literally watch people. All fine and good. We'll talk more about those techniques in a minute, but that's primary data collection. Or questionnaires, what we often think of when we think of research. Ask them. We can use primary data to generate new ideas through in-depth interviews and focus groups. So what do you think about Tinder? Let's sit down and talk about it. What's your image? Have you had any experiences with Tinder? Do you know other people that have used it? Are there issues? Now we get some stuff out and we say, okay, this is a small group of people. Let's do a major study to see if it holds to be true. Idea evaluation from those ideas generated by mail, online, telephone, personal surveys, all that's primary data. Takes a while to get that stuff done. Can be costly.
I guess we do market.
Here's Muller over at Timken talking about how they do B2B research.
I guess we do market research both ways. We have people in market manager positions. That's their full-time job, is to, for the market they're assigned to, their job is to go understand that market, the trends in the industry, what do customers want, and that's really where a lot of the ideas for new product innovation comes from. We also, though, will use outside firms for, I'll say, the really big jobs. And an example of that would be understanding the wind energy market, which is a, you know, an emerging market where if you're a gear drive manufacturer, a bearing manufacturer, it's really in the news today. And the wind energy market is so huge and it's so different in every country. That's an example where we've hired an outside company that does market research. That's their livelihood. And they can do a faster job and a more global job than we
can do, and find the results out of this, suggest things for the future role of Timken. So sometimes you have an in-house group, your own researchers. For some projects, they're fine. Other things are too big, too global. You can hire outside agencies to do that work for you. So secondary data. Advantages of it is it's fast. It's almost always available pretty quickly on the internet, on your files, from your data. relatively inexpensive, and sometimes it might give you good enough solutions. My example of the boss walking out and wanting answers 15 minutes from now and something in Atlanta, can't do primary data. And sometimes it points you in the right direction for primary research. This is what they found, this is what they know, this is the trend. Let's see what's going on. Disadvantages, by definition, it's out of date. It was collected some other time for some other project on some other people. So the sample or the definitions or the categories of the research may not be appropriate for your work. And almost always, given you have a particular set of goals and objectives, it's not going to be specific enough to answer your specific questions, right? Primary data focuses on the specific problem at hand. You control everything about it, the questions, the sample, the time period. But it's costly, and it takes time to get it done. So there's a trade-off here, right? And you have to be aware of these as you go into a research situation. If you remember our friend over here at Protégé, he is talking about how they do research. They are a research company. Let's hear what they have to say.
Way before my time in market research, you know, they were doing mall intercepts. They were calling people on the phone. They were just really talking to people, you know, how we normally would, or even like doing mail-in surveys. Then in the early 2000s, everything navigated to being online. And so we saw a big uptick in online quant and qual work. Even still have some in-person shops coming to us today saying, hey, now we can't do that. And in order for our business to stay relevant, we're having to adopt to Zoom calls. So still kind of having that face-to-face aspect, but doing it online. But that was all self-reported data. So where this is continuing to navigate to is online work, because of course it's more efficient and cost-effective to conduct online research than say fly a team to, you know, Minnesota to go to a specific mall and try to intercept people. So that is still very important, but we also want to have verified data as much as possible. So a lot of investments for Protégé is going towards verified data. The way that we do that is looking at behavioral data and also shopping data. With behavioral data, that is using a browser extension. So you might be using a web browser extension for, you know, say like Honey. That's a big one that people use for coupons, or RetailMeNot, another big one for coupons. We have something similar for our members. But additionally, what that's doing and what they've consented to in order to earn rewards is that we can track the websites that they're going to. And so we can tell if one of our members is going to Amazon.com and when they check out. And then from there, we can say, okay, you bought items from Amazon on June 3rd, and then start digging into what they were buying, what took them there, et cetera. With the verified shopping data, that is becoming really valuable as well, because in the CPG and retail space, everybody's doing research at some point in their product lifecycle. And so with that shopper data, we're able to see like a longitudinal data set. So this has been 2 years in the making. And so what we're continuing to track and be able to pick out is this survey respondent was going to, you know, Kroger grocery store, for most of 2020, they were buying Coca-Cola, but then why, you know, around the holidays, November and December, why did they switch to Pepsi? And so we've got that verified data. We're not guessing. We're not asking them to report that themselves. We've got it there, cold, raw data. And then our clients can go in and dig out, hey, we noticed these trends. You know, what's going on? Maybe they were having family over, and maybe the family is vehemently against Coca-Cola and they like Pepsi. Who knows? So all in all, it's getting to having verified data so that you can get more granular in the questions that you ask folks. The best way to leverage that shopper data or behavioral data is by saying, we can see that these people were shopping at specific stores within a specific time frame or bought specific items, and then still go do a quant or qual study with them, just knowing that it's verified.
So when you ask people, they may or may not remember accurately. They may or may not tell you the truth about whatever's going on. So here with Protégé, they have their people that have signed on board to be part of their member set, and they are able to track what they actually are doing on their computer, see what things they're actually buying, verified shopper data. Anybody use Honey or any other coupon saving thing on their computer? So whether or not you know when you downloaded it and clicked, it's now following the sites that you go to, the things that you're browsing, the things that you buy, and reporting it back, perhaps not to Protégé, but to somebody else, to Honey, so that you become part of this data set on shopping behavior, what you were actually doing.
Way before my time in market research, so, you know, they were doing mall intercepts.
Okay.
They were calling people.
Shh, quiet. So I see I had a couple blanks here that didn't pop up. So if you're filling out your form, all this is self-reported data. Protégé moved to verified data, including looking at verified data and shopping data. These things are not asking for opinions. They're actually observing real behavior. That's valuable for marketers who want to know what's going on. We rolled out this campaign a while ago in your area. Did your pattern of search change? Did your pattern of purchase change? At what time period? All cool stuff for us, yeah? Fender, where's my rock and rollers or my guitarists or my musicians? No, one person. We don't have a very musical group here. I'll see you later on the rock and roll front. All right, so Fender finds research. Fender study finds half of new guitarists are women. A survey of a representative sample, they're claiming here we have a good random sample, of guitar players in the US and the UK found that women account for 50% of all beginner and aspirational players. And the instrument maker, Fender, is adjusting its marketing focus accordingly. Research for action. So here we have ads that are now, hypothetically at least, appealing to the women who are interested in learning guitar, learning to play guitar. 2020 saw an astronomic spike in the popularity of the guitar. This increase in demand is unprecedented, and it keeps growing steadily. For some context, during the height of the 2009 financial crisis, guitar sales plummeted, reaching a low of $821 million in the US. Despite slow and steady growth in sales since then, many thought that the guitar was on its way out. But with the COVID-19 pandemic, more effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, and the resulting global lockdown, interest in guitars has grown rapidly. Guitar sales increased by 15% between 19 and 20, with online retailers amassing the bulk of these sales. That is thanks to a recent wave of beginner guitarists, with the majority of them picking up the acoustic guitar. Top brands like Fender have experienced record sales, and so have retailers like Guitar Center and Sweetwater. Historically, the guitar playing universe used to be dominated by men, but roughly 45% of those started playing in 2020 are female. Might be important for you to know that if you're a marketer, a retailer, a manufacturer of guitars, who's your target audience? How should you be advertising? How should you be appealing to them? A fairly important source of secondary data in the business world for marketers is what's called syndicated services. Syndicated research is conducted by a market research firm in an area that might be of interest to several different companies or organizations within an industry. The market research firm, the syndicated research firm, leverages its industry expertise and experience to determine the subject and scope of the study, including the questions that are asked, the populations targeted, and offers its results and analysis out to multiple clients. Oftentimes, the stuff that you're seeing in business in the news or marketing the news comes from this sort of study. Somebody's run a major study. They have a bunch of clients that are going to pay for that study to get the real in-depth stuff. I don't pay a lot of money to get the information. We get the high-level stuff. Benefits of syndicated research. It's efficient from a cost viewpoint because the same research results are purchased by several companies. The cost of performing the research is spread out among those companies. Investing in syndicated research is often a cost-efficient solution for firms that want to gain valuable market insight. It can give an overview of the market that would be hard for one company to get, provides a clear representation of who the players are in the market, whether they are customers, clients, or businesses. I was stunned when I realized 100 years ago that the appliance manufacturer that I worked for made appliances, sent them out in the marketplace, had almost no idea what happened next. Didn't really know what stores they went into, what geographic areas they were being sold in, what salespeople on the front line were saying about them. We eventually did some research of that, and I imagine it's a little better today with computers tracking stuff, but they just didn't know what was going on, who their customers were, how things were playing out downstream. Syndicated research can identify industry trends, useful for organizations looking to understand the market landscape, how they fit into that landscape. Measures brand awareness, brand strength, consumers' perceptions. It allows multiple companies who invest in syndicated research to see how their brands and product offerings are viewed among customers and potential customers compared to those of their competitors. How do you like Crest toothpaste? How do you like Sensodyne toothpaste? How do you like Arm & Hammer baking soda toothpaste? How strongly do you feel about those? When would you buy one versus the other? Why do you like one versus the other? I'm going to go up here, watch your cord. Yes? Slide before that? That one? You bet. And it offers competitive intelligence that gives information on how to best position your companies out in that competitive market. How does Tinder decide where to position itself? Presumably they've done research to see where everybody else sits and how they want to be perceived. Syndicated sources can be classed based on the unit of measurement, either households or consumers, B2C, or institutions, B2B. Household or consumer data can be obtained from surveys, asking people, diary panels, having a group of people that stays with you over time, and they fill out information, often on a computer, letting you know what they're doing currently, what they're seeing, what they're buying, what ads they're watching, or electronic or scanner services. How many of you guys have a grocery card, reward card thing from the grocery store? Anybody as you go through? So while they don't care about you as an individual, they want to know, in this store, what are these consumers doing? So you get a discount of some dollar amount off your purchase, and they get data back on whether you're buying Coke or Pepsi during the holidays. Institutional data is obtained from retailers, wholesalers, or industrial firms. So that's the idea of knowing what's going on in that channel of distribution before it gets out to the ultimate consumer through the retailer. Visual learners, so here is the B2C side. Here's our households or consumers. They're providing data through surveys. Do you remember us talking, maybe we talked about the ultimate consumer, we talked about their lifestyle. There's psychographic and lifestyle research, general research, advertising effectiveness research through surveys. Panel data, somebody said to me one day, I think their parents was involved in a Nielsen panel. Was anybody, that person happened to be here today? No, that's that sort of research. So either focusing on your purchases and or the media exposure, what you watch, what you listen to, and then electronic scanner services, tracking volume of sales, when you buy things, where you buy things, and in some cases, of course, you may be in a particular neighborhood that gets cable TV or localized streaming TV, and they're running one set of commercials in your area, another set of commercials up in a different area. They know where you are, they don't care who you are, and they wait to see how effective their work is. On the institutional side, they can audit retailers and wholesalers, and in terms of manufacturing, industrial firms, they can do direct inquiries, clip information off of the internet or off of newspapers about what's going on, and look at corporate reports. All of that brings information back to the community. Internet databases that marketers can access, sometimes for free. Online databases like LexisNexis, the U.S. Census, ProQuest, statistical and financial data like the Wall Street Journal, CNBC, Investors, Fox Business, portal and search engines, obviously, like Google, USA.gov, and eventually I'm going to have to add in, aren't I, ChatGPT as a source for some of this information. We'll have to see what happens there. So there's lots of ways that marketers can begin to get useful data. All right, primary data examples. Mechanical collection, Nielsen observes you because you're on their panel, you agree to do it. Sometimes they'll have a camera with your TV. It watches to see who's in the room watching which channels right now because people lie about what they're watching. Oh, yeah, I only watch PBS News. No, you're watching Homer Simpson. So who's watching it? When are they watching it? TiVo or other DVRs like from Spectrum, they know what you watch, when you watch it. So you you saved, how many people watching, is it The Last of Us? The Last of Us, you're watching that, right? You saw it Sunday night. Did you wait on Sunday night? Did you wait till Monday? Did you go back and look it again? Did you go back to another episode? It's tracking all that to let the marketers know what's going on. Web cookies, are also a way of tracking what's going on. Personal observation, anybody work for a place that has mystery shoppers? No? So mystery shopper, oh, you did? Yeah? So they let you know there'd be a mystery shopper perhaps coming by. Oh, it's not you? You weren't waving. You were just talking. You? Did you wave? Mystery shopper. So as the employee, you knew there could be mystery shoppers coming by. They let you know that. They let you know you regularly have to keep up to standards, right? And then I don't know if you ever saw a mystery shopper, but they should be rating you or grading you. And you should hear back how you did when that mystery shopper came by. Obviously, primary data, you can actually sign up to be a mystery shopper, depending where you are. So here's the secret shopper program, actionable intelligence delivered, measuring what matters, the premier mystery shopper company, drive exceptional bottom line performance through insightful, actionable marketing intelligence, the cutting edge consumer experience secret shopper. So it talks both to their consumer, both to their clients, and to people who want to be secret shoppers. Videotaping. Videotaping can be done in good ways or in bad ways. I will tell you a true, as told to me, story that will be a little disturbing, but I'll tell the story anyhow, of how people didn't think this through very well. Just for a minute, bear with me. So they want to do real research. They want to see how people are really behaving. This is a bra company. And as you may know, the standard idea is that many women don't know how to properly fit bras. You've heard of that. Nordstrom might actually have for women a bra fitting session where they bring in experts to talk to you about your bra fitting. For real. Guys don't know this. And so what this company did was they wanted to see what was going wrong. So they videotaped women in retail trying on bras. Somebody might have said, is that really a good idea to do that? And how's it going to look if word gets out? So obviously, when people found out they were being videotaped trying on bras, that was not a good thing. That's not the way to do good research, please. On the other hand, this sort of videotaping is OK. So here we see a heat map where they recorded people walking through a store. And the hot, the orange areas are places where people stop, look at something, pick something up, maybe even bought something. Moving over to the cool areas where people just breezed on by. And they did this mapping for a great number of people, created a heat map from it, and you get a visualization of where people are stopping and where they're just breezing by. Could that be important to you if you were a retailer? What people are stopping to look at, what people are just not paying any attention to, you bet. So videotaping. Ethnographic research, in a little bit, today or tomorrow, we'll hear from something called the Merchants of Cool, where MTV sends their researchers out to, an exaggeration I'll say, live with, but be with, talk to, one-on-one, their target audience, individually. We'll hear Fred Hunt eventually talk about having researchers follow around people buying paint. From the time that they go to buy the paint to the time they go to use the paint, be with them, the whole process, ethnographic research. Another way to collect primary data is by crowdsourcing it. Field Agent, a consumer app for primary data collection. You can make money with your iPhone by completing small jobs with Field Agent. What is it? An app that connects clients, marketers, in need of market research data with agents, users, you, who can provide it. App users become agents answering survey questions and performing small tasks for cash sums, allowing the clients to gather large samples of data via crowdsourcing. We've made it our mission to pay people real money through their iPhone for doing work. We've paid over $1.8 million to thousands of agents. And apparently, it's still out there, so retail your way. Field Agent Solutions lets you audit store, drive trial, generate reviews, and connect with shoppers anywhere, anytime. Consider Field Agent. Here's a bunch of companies that are using Field Agent to collect primary data. We can, of course, create a survey. Yeah? And we can do that by, well, talking to consumers. So one thing we might do is to talk to consumers to generate question ideas. I don't even know what people think at all about marketing 25010. I just don't know. So I can't even begin to ask you questions about it because I don't even know what you think about. So what I might do is talk to you one-on-one. Hey, what do you think about marketing 25? What do you like? What don't you like? Okay, I begin to get ideas, talking to individuals about my brand, about my product. I also can obviously engage in really in-depth interviews, not just, hey, how you doing? Let's have a casual chat. So we can spend a lot of time together exploring whatever the brand concept is. Focus groups. Anybody ever been in a focus group that you know of? Do you know you were in a focus group? This is where we get together, 10 or 12 people. We do several different groups. We have a basic set of questions we want to get through, but each group can take its own direction, and you find interesting things. So I forget if I used this example before or not. Long time ago, appliance manufacturer working with microwave ovens, we did not yet know what sort of controls people wanted. Did they want dials? Did they want buttons that they pushed? Did they want a flat screen panel? Did they want sliders? We didn't know. Created a bunch of mock-ups, put them all in a truck. This is why it takes time and it costs money. Drove the truck up to a focus group session in Atlanta, had five different groups of 10 people, Chicago, it doesn't matter. Five people come in, 10 people come in at a time, and we talk about it. So we have some questions that we're trying to follow through. But then you say, I think that the control panel should be purple. Oh, that's interesting. What do you think about a purple control panel? Do you like that idea, not idea? How about you guys? Okay, what else do you think about the color of the control panel? So we wander off in new areas that we didn't think about, and then we come back to the questions. And you do this with a bunch of groups, which can begin to generate new question ideas. Fuzzy front end techniques. These are unusual ways to identify cool new trends. So you agree to sign up for my research study on athletic shoes, and I ask you to, over the next week, because we're going to pay you for the research study, I ask you to collect a bunch of TikTok videos where you feel people are wearing interesting new shoes. And you bring that list in to my research study. And we're going to talk about what everybody in the group sees in these TikTok videos of shoes, for example. All right, so we come up with some ideas we think are pointing in a direction. Now we have to evaluate the ideas. How can we evaluate those ideas as being good, bad, true, false? We can do it with personal interviews, telephone surveys. Hard to do these days in the B2C world, but B2B, you can still do a telephone survey, mail or fax surveys, email or internet surveys. To the extent people still go to malls, we can stop people in malls and ask them, we've heard that TikTok is viewed as a hookup website only. What do you think? So we can begin to evaluate the ideas that we've come up with. We ask different kinds of questions in our survey, open-ended questions. If students asked, I would tell them that marketing 25010 is. You can see that that could generate an array of answers, right? Some short, some long, some on target, some wandering. This can provide rich data for the researcher, but it can be a real pain to try to make sense out of. How do you code the answer? Is it positive? Is it negative? What category does it fit in? How does it fit against other answers you've gotten? So open-ended questions can be useful, interesting, and difficult to categorize and work with as you try to turn it into quantitative data. So we might change into a closed-ended or fixed alternative. Marketing 25010 is outstanding, pretty good, fair, pretty bad, horrible, not very rich, but you can see it'd be easy to quantify and work with the data, right? Dichotomous. Here we have one of two responses. How old are you? Less than 21? 21 or older. Pretty easy to work with. Do you think that marketing 25010 is a good class for business students? Yes, no. Pretty simple to answer, pretty easy to work with as a researcher. Semantic differential. This is an interesting technique where you're going to develop sort of a personality of the brand, a personality of the product, a personality of the thing you're going to talk about. You do research to find the interesting, important adjectives that describe the brand. or in this case, the class. So you've decided through early research, appropriate adjectives for the class are interesting or boring, simple, complex, useful or useless, good or bad. Now, obviously, the quality of your work is going to depend on whether or not you got the right adjectives here, right? So here we have bipolar adjectives, and we ask a bunch of people to answer the questions. And then for that bunch of people, for that brand or that product or that class, we post the averages to get a profile. So in this case, here is the profile for Marketing 25010. It's pretty interesting, in between simple and complex. Pretty useful, pretty good. Now, what good does that do? It's by itself not very much, not very useful information by itself. But we create another profile for a competing brand, for another company, for another class. Let's compare this to thermocalculus, which I don't believe is an actual course. So here's the profile for thermocalculus compared to the profile for marketing. It's boring, very complex, somewhat useful, and in between good and bad. With this sort of profile, you can begin to think about where you want to be positioned, how you want to look against the competition, what you should be shifting to make it more useful. Okay? So that's semantic differential. Likert scale, respondents rate the degree of agreement with a statement. Often people mislabel their research as being Likert scale when it is not. So you give a person a statement and you ask them to their degree of agreement with them. Marketing 25010 is a good class. Strongly disagree, disagree, neutral, agree, strongly agree. 5-point scales, 7-point scales. And again, easy to quantify the results. Any one of these can be useful. Your chosen format has to match your goal. You want rich, in-depth knowledge. Don't be asking yes-no questions. You aren't getting anything out of it. You want quick and dirty stuff. You want to know good or bad? Ask good or bad. You're there. Writing questions can be an art that critically influence the results. You've all heard the idea, I presume, of a leading question. Most truly patriotic Americans prefer to purchase products manufactured in the United States. Do you prefer to purchase products manufactured in the United States? Do you see how that question might be leading the responses in a particular direction? It's a little subtle there. Do you see how that might be leading the response? So if I say no, obviously I'm not a patriotic American. What was the question that was asked, giving you, manager, the research you're about to make a decision on? Probability sample, questions being asked could be important. Panel data, an ongoing group of consumers or stores who agree to provide information. Experimental data, where we carefully cause the control, like the ad or the price or the packaging, and we measure the important results we're interested in. Are people paying attention? What do they believe? What is their attitude? Did it create sales? A blind taste test can be an experiment. This was an interesting one, I thought, where they did a blind taste test on, of all things, ketchup. How many people like ketchup in general? How many people have a strong opinion about the best ketchup? Only one person has a strong opinion. You've never been to a restaurant where they serve the other brand that you don't like? Yeah? What's your strong preference? Heinz ketchup. Anybody like Heinz ketchup in particular? Oh, now people are saying yes. Okay, this was a study done with a blind taste test on ketchups. So this guy actually wanted to run it. Here's the various ketchups that he ran in the test. There's your favorite, Heinz, Hunt's, French's, Hellman's. I didn't know Hellman's made ketchup. Here's how you do a blind taste test. As you see, we don't let you know what brand is what, although he's revealing it here. And the results of the blind test were the winner was Annie's Organic Ketchup. The runner-up was Whole Foods 365 Organic Ketchup. Sorry, third place, Heinz. So a true blind taste test being reported as an experiment. Test markets, this is where we do the whole shebang. we go to two cities that are pretty similar to one another, Akron and Rochester, New York. And we know they're pretty similar for the target market we're interested in. And we create the entire marketing mix, the product, the price, the place, the promotion, and we roll it out in Akron, and we see the results. And we create the other, the alternative, product, price, place, promotion, and we roll that out in Rochester, and we see the results. That's a big experiment. That's expensive. It's also as real as it gets, right? Because you're actually doing the real thing. You're not asking people, what do you think about this ad? It's happening. Social listening, another way to collect primary data. You can track your social media platforms for mentions and conversations related to your brand, and then analyze them for insights to discover how to act. Again, I apologize because I'm old and senile. I don't remember which stories I've already told, but took a group of students to Nestle's in Vevey headquarters, Vevey, Switzerland. They had one panel where they were tracking social media mentions of any of their brands, and they got a boatload of brands, so it was a pretty big lot of screens. Over here, they were responding to criticism and comments on this set of screens. This people were busy over here, and back here they were seeing the end results of their return remarks and training people who came into corporate headquarters how to go regionally and do this sort of work. So it's a two-step process. First, you have to monitor social media channels for mentions of your brand, your competitors, your products, keywords that are related to your interest, to your business. And then you have to analyze the information for ways to put what you learn into action. Sometimes it's as small as responding to a happy customer or a bad customer, an unhappy customer. Something as big as shifting your entire brand position. And Danone using social insight to stay relevant. Danone uses social listening to get a deeper understanding of what really matters to people, which has become all the more important since the onset of the pandemic. We don't collect data just to collect data. We collect it because we want to make managerial action. So one executive brags to another, I get 300 emails a day. The other responds, that's nothing. I get 500 emails a day and 50 voicemails. Unfortunately, this is not a joke. There's not a funny punchline. The reality is, as we manage in the networked world, we're increasingly overwhelmed with information and communication. And as our enterprises go more global, and that becomes the norm, emails become ridiculously long just to try to make a decision. So we get overload. We need new ways to govern, new ways to measure and make decisions in this extended enterprise. Obviously, what we're hoping is that IS, IT, and research helps us to overcome this ridiculous situation. So, information systems. Ongoing organized procedures to generate, analyze, disseminate, store, and retrieve information for use in making decisions. I keep asking and don't get very many hands. Where are my IS, IT, CIS people? Anybody? Nobody? Nobody's helping me behind the scenes to do the work that I need to make my management decisions, so I'm in trouble. So those are what those folks are doing behind the scenes for us, we hope. So internally, we're collecting a whole bunch of data from our customer orders, our customer data, our inventory, our sales calls, our promotions, and putting that in a data warehouse. We're getting a bunch of information from external sources, global sources, trade association data, U.S. Census data, Internet of Things, single source services that we've been talking about, and collecting that into our data. We've got a cloud environment for data storage and data cloud computing capabilities and artificial intelligence looking into our data warehouse. And when done right, we begin to get analytical tools of all this stuff to organize, manipulate, analyze, and present data, giving us results for our marketing research through our marketing researcher or data scientist that helps answer those important questions that we need to run a business. And, of course, then shape our marketing plan. Data mining is done on that data warehouse. The data mining is an analytic process that extracts hidden predictive information from large data sets to find links between consumers' purchasing patterns and marketing actions that a human just wouldn't have time to find and see. Too much data, too complex, too many interactions. We let our AI, our data mining, do this, and it comes up with interesting things that we might not see on our own. Data warehouses can be analyzed in the same way as a database, where you already know the patterns that you're trying to look for. But due to the size, it would be a slow and cumbersome process to go into this massive data warehouse. So we use more advanced statistical techniques. We use artificial intelligence, called data mining, that allow marketers to identify patterns and meaningful relationships that they just wouldn't find on their own. A little example. You guys know Harrah's? Harrah's, anybody know what they are, what area they're in, what field they're in? Nobody? No gamblers here? So Harrah's is a big gambling company. They're big in Vegas and elsewhere. And they did a bunch of data collection by having their customers use ID cards as they bet in different places. That's how they got their money in and got their money out. And they were able then to analyze massive quantities of data using data mining to produce 90 consumer segments based on people's gambling behavior and their profit projections. And based on this, they were able to determine which promotional package to send to which client group. You're the big roller. Of course, I'm going to give you free air, free hotel, free booze, because you're going to play and sometimes win big, but often lose a lot. Now, I personally play the nickel slots. They don't care about me at all. They're going to give me money not to come. I mean, so there are different segments out there based on this data. It was quite successful for them. How many guys have heard this terrible controversy about Dilbert? I'm so sad. I love Dilbert's examples. It turns out that he just went online and did a racist rant. And newspapers all over the country are dropping Dilbert. I don't know if he has any distribution left. I love the guy as a cartoonist. Apparently, I don't care for him much as an individual and may have to change all my examples over time because he's not a nice person. Anyhow, this was data mining humor from Dilbert. Here's Dogbert, the nasty consultant, talking to the stupid pointy hair boss. You need to do data mining to uncover secret hidden sales trends. We were just talking about that. If you mine the data hard enough, you can also find messages from God. That's unclear. Sales to left-handed squirrels are up, and God says your tie doesn't go with that shirt. Or we have a gigantic database full of customer behavior information. We just talked about that. Excellent. We can use nonlinear math and data mining technology to optimize our retail channels. Pointy Hair Boss says, if that's the same thing as spam, we're having a good meeting here. It is not. All right, so we've done our research. Now we're going to develop our findings. We're going to analyze the data using the appropriate techniques that you've learned in your data analytics course, maybe. Present the findings, communicate it in a clear manner for action, which is what we're trying to get to. Then we're going to take the action as managers. Make the recommendations, implement the actions, and then use marketing research to evaluate the results. Did we do the right thing? This is going to just about take us to the end of class. It's a great example from MTV a while ago, using marketing research in interesting ways to rearrange their world. This is the little giving credit to the
Online is made possible by the annual financial support of PBS viewers like you. Thank you.
And then we move into the example.
Of the five media giants, the coolest conglomerate on the block is Viacom. And Viacom's crown jewel, there on the second floor, is MTV, which last year earned the company $1 billion in profits. A few years ago, when their ratings began to slip.
There was a perception that MTV had lost its way a bit with the young consumer. Ratings were down somewhat. Some of the trend studies said that we were less cool, less creative than before.
So MTV had the humility to realize that cool was not their birthright, that it belongs to kids and kids keep changing. if they wanted to stay cool, they'd have to change right along with them.
MTV felt like we needed to get a closer connection to the audience. But we said, if we know more about them, know more about their lives, know more about who they are, what they want, what they don't want, we can make a better MTV as a better connection with the audience if we talk to them and listen to them a lot more.
We immersed ourselves in research about the fall of 97 and have been able to turn that around to where now our rankings when it comes to creative or original or funky or anything you would care about musically relevant have went way, way up, and our ratings are our highest in their history.
The new MTV is all about learning what kids really want and delivering it to them.
Yeah, this new CD, Granddaddy.
To ensure that bond stays strong, MTV must understand where teen culture is moving. Market research is the mantra, and its guru is Todd Cunningham.
Some of this music is dead on for exactly what kind of stuff that our audience is going to want. And the research efforts at MTV are certainly legendary. There's been a kind of feverish addiction to research and understanding young people, and that's been embraced from the very top down.
MTV let us in on their techniques. Todd Cunningham told us to meet him at an address in the small town of Island, New Jersey. A short time after we arrived, a black town car pulled up. Cunningham, a former advertising industry executive, emerged with a member of his staff. This little field trip, Cunningham had explained, is called an ethnography study, in which MTV market researchers visit a typical fan in his home.
Hey,
Today, MTV is meeting John, an ordinary kid in every respect, who is carefully screened to make sure he is just that. It is hoped that by studying John in his natural habitat, MTV might gain insight into one of the most valuable segments of their viewing demographic, the teenage male.
I'd love to see, like, clothes. Like, what's your favorite thing you have? What's your favorite shirt?
Probably my sweaters, they're my drawers, if you want to see
them. Okay, well, we can look at that in a minute. What else? What are the kind of things you wear usually? Like, what's...
I wear a lot of, like, khaki pants.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, I have some suits for church or whatever.
We shut the door in their bedrooms and talk to them about issues that they feel like are really important to them. We talk with them about, what it's like to date today. What's like dealing with their parents, what things stress them out the most, what things are like really on the hearts and minds of them and their peers. I'm just curious about like things with like, you know, obviously if you want, just like with your girlfriend and stuff like this. And I mean, this is, we always just ask these kind of questions about, are you like, how long have you guys been dating?
Since June 1st.
It's captured on video. So we have a camera crew, sound and light crew there. We cut that videotape together, put it to music, edit it in an MTV-style way. We then take that around and show it to various department meetings, share with them the insights that we've learned.
So what happens to all this careful research, all the hours and dollars that MTV spends learning about who our kids really are? When all the tape is reviewed, what portrait of the American teenage male emerges?
The water
goes. Oh, God! Hot dude on my leg!
His critics call him the Mook. That's right, M-O-O-K, Mook. And you can find him almost any hour of the day or night, somewhere on MTV. He's not real, he's a character. Crude, loud, obnoxious, and in your face. He's Tom Green of the Tom Green Show. And he's the daredevils on Jackass who indulge in dignity-defying feats like poo diving.
Brian Dunn, and this is poo diving.
Oh, bro! He's those frat boys and their whipped cream bikini girlfriends on MTV's constantly recurring spring break specials.
Hi, Terrence. What brand of pants am I wearing? Let me see.
He has migrated to MTV's sister network, Comedy Central. Where he's the cartoon cutouts of South Park, or the lads on The Man Show.
The Juggies look nice, don't they?
Oh, yeah! Eat those rings.
So does the whole teenage experience come down to this? Are our boys mooks? Is John a mook? I don't think so. Maybe all that research isn't really about understanding John as a person. It's about understanding John as a customer. I mean, they don't call it human research or people research. They call it market research.
The MTV machine does listen very carefully to children. When corporate revenues depend on being ahead of the curve, you have to listen. You have to know exactly what they want and exactly what they're thinking so that you can give them what you want them to have.
It's funny to think that the most advanced form of marketing today comes in the form of a 300-pound body slam. Professional wrestling is the most popular form of entertainment among teenage boys in America. Today, wrestling is sheer spectacle, a magnificently honed lure for the teenage male channel surfer. And where there's pop, there's money. That's why wrestling has been propagated across the entire spectrum of teen media. It's broadcast 15 hours a week on 5 different networks.
Good
and is seen
five.
By 15
okay.
million people.
3 more minutes.
It is huge with our audience at sort of program levels that I could have never imagined. It is the hottest thing going among males 18 to 24 and, in fact, among teen boys. And so we felt like while we don't want that to be the defining element of our business, it was okay to be in the game.
It was simply too big to ignore.
That's what it was.
Check, check. Okay. So, of course, views and attitudes have moved on. But how many of you guys grew up with South Park? Are you guys still watching South Park sometimes today? Okay, it's out there. MTV has moved on to other things. But what an interesting approach to a major corporation going through the 5 steps of the research project that then drove their entire marketing plan for a time period. Mini test 6 tonight, midterm 1 tomorrow. Thank you for being here. Have a good day.